Before I jump into the economics, I want to show you three results that are, I think, interesting and significant. First of all, with Housing First, there's been a lot of question about to what extent can Housing First be effective for people with substance use disorder. As you saw, there is a significant proportion of our sample, more in the high needs group, who do have substance use disorder at baseline. And what we find here is kind of combining both groups, that is the high needs and the moderate needs, overall in the, the legend is not very clear, but the solid, or rather the black line is people with substance use disorders at baseline. The gray lines are people without. The solid line represents experimental, the dotted line, treatment as usual. So what you can see is that people with substance use disorder are housed less than people without, whether they're in the experimental group or the treatment as usual group. So in other words, substance use disorder is a problem. It impedes people being housed, but it doesn't really affect the relative effectiveness of Housing First. So that's one thing. Now, we were all a little bit, all in the study, a little bit disappointed to see how the effects from the quantitative scales on quality of life, functioning, symptoms, etc., seemed to give results that were kind of somewhat muted. The impressions of the clinicians were that this was making a really big difference in people's lives. The qualitative component of the study, which we don't have the time to go into in detail, but the qualitative component of the study did indicate a picture fairly consistent with what the clinicians were saying, which was that this was making a very big difference in people's lives. I haven't read the reports from all the sites, but I did read the qualitative report from the Montreal site. And it's really quite striking how people report greater feelings of peace. You even see, I mean, you didn't see any difference on the substance abuse on the gain, but actually if you use finer instruments, which Vancouver did and Montreal did, an instrument that captures more quantity of use, in Montreal, for the moderate need groups, we do see a difference. And it's reflected in the qualitative interviews where people will say, well, I feel so much better in my apartment that I don't feel the need to self-medicate. So I consume less alcohol. Or, I really like being here, and I know that I'm going to need to pay my share of the rent come next month, so I'm not going to blow all my money on alcohol and drugs. So you actually see kind of explanatory mechanisms in what people are saying for some of the effects that we observe. So the differences are very large. And one way to summarize those findings is as follows. And this needs some refinements, it's still preliminary, but we classified the trajectories of the individuals in the study according to what they were reporting in a number of domains that came up in the interviews. We classified them as either, kind of, this is an overwhelmingly positive trajectory, this is overwhelmingly negative, or this is mixed. And what we see in the Housing First group is kind of 61% of the trajectories, so that's 180 people, it's not tiny for qualitative work, report positive trajectories. A little bit less than 30 mixed, and about 10% negative. There were negative instances. For example, some individuals were highly paranoid and just distrusted the intervention team, very difficult to make progress with them. Other instances were women who were victimized. One in Montreal, one woman's brother caught up with her, moved into her apartment, brought in all his buddies, and made her life intolerable. So, which led kind of some sites like Moncton to develop like protected sites where we broke the sort sort of scattered site model, but made an environment where people could not be found and hassled, disturbed by victimizers of various stuff. In the treatment as usual group, you can see that there are far fewer positive trajectories and slightly more mixed and many more negative trajectories. And a third finding that kind of you really need a large study like this to be able to come to is that fidelity to the Housing First model does matter. The scale that was developed and administered on two occasions by the national team that went to visit the sites did a very careful assessment of fidelity, looking at records and so on, focus groups of participants. So it was done really in a state-of-the-art way. Concludes that higher fidelity is associated with better housing outcomes and higher self-reported quality of life. So that's another very significant finding. So now I'll come to the economic impacts. I do want to acknowledge kind of a few individuals who've helped quite a lot. So our objective here was to, what I'm going to present here, is to evaluate the net impact of Housing First on average cost of health, social and justice service use, as well as disability and welfare benefits, net of employment income. And whereas the previous presentation stopped at 12 months, I'm going to present you all the data to 21, 24 months. So this is based on three questionnaires. So it's all, at this point, we have some administrative data, but we have not integrated it into the economic analysis at this point. It's kind of, we don't have the same data at all the sites. We can't actually share the data at a participant level across sites. So we're fairly impeded in using administrative data for this. So we have the health, social, and justice service use, which is every 6 months, which looks at essentially ambulatory service use. The residential timeline follow back, which goes with the participant, follows back night by night over the previous 3 months, actually 6 months we actually didn't administer this at baseline. We waited till a 3 month interview because the baseline interview was already very long and went back 6 months. So we get all the overnight stays. If people have an apartment, but they're hospitalized while they have the apartment, we know that, we take that into account. And then the vocational timeline follow back, which gets all their income. In the analysis I'll be showing, we have ignored actually illegal income. But we do have data on that. But we did include welfare and disability benefits, income from panhandling, gifts from family, we all consider as social contributions, and then regular employment is subtracted. So this is this is a societal perspective for the analysis, but if any of you are economists, you'll be perhaps a bit surprised that we included the welfare and disability benefits in the analysis. Usually this would be considered as a transfer payment and not included in an economic analysis. But in this particular case, given that these are individuals with quite low incomes and that the welfare and disability benefits contribute to whatever outcomes we see, it doesn't seem very reasonable to just say kind of this is a neutral transfer payment. This really is part of the cost of delivering the intervention. So we made this decision. One limitation is that cost of medications are not included. We made a decision at the beginning that this would be too difficult to collect in a reliable way from the participants. We would rely on administrative data. We did not realize at the beginning how, in the end, it would prove impossible due to kind of restrictions by the provincial governments to share these data at the participant level across provinces. So that is a limitation. We were able to see in Montreal with the administrative data we do have that there is not much difference actually in medication costs across groups from what we can see so far. The cost data are presented on an annualized basis. Unit costs were estimated using a top-down approach, with 2009-2010 annual reports. This, I want to stress that we spent an awful lot of time. We actually haven't completely finished refining the unit costs for five sites. This work was centralized in Montreal. We've tried to do it in a methodologically consistent way, including overhead, indirect costs, capital costs, in a consistent way. A paper by Stephen Huang led us to adjust hospitalization costs for homelessness. So, results, briefly. Well, first of all, kind of one issue that comes up a lot, certainly in Canada, is kind of how much do homeless people cost? And figures of around $100,000 are often bandied about. Kind of, the evidence we have so far suggests that it doesn't normally reach $100,000. This is more what we find in our sample. This is actually not kind of the simple sample average. It's like a fitted value from a GLM model that adjusts for a lot of different differences in the characteristics of the samples in different sites. Like, for example, Vancouver had more high-need people than Montreal. So what we get is something that looks more like around $50,000 in our sample. So, of course, if one were to generalize to a homeless population that did not include people with mental illness, possibly the results would be a bit different. But still, this is a fairly large sample. I think these are about the best estimates currently available for the cost of homelessness in Canadian cities. So our basic conclusion is that there are significant but not complete cost offsets. So for the high-need group, here's what we did. We show to the left, treatment as usual versus housing first. You can see there's a bit of a difference at baseline. None of this at this point is statistically tested. Probably most of this is not statistically significant due to the large variability in costs. Over the 0 month to the end of this study, you can see in green the cost of the intervention itself. So this is the full cost of the intervention. We're not using self-reports to assign the cost of the intervention here. And you can see that what I've shown here is the difference in height between this bar and this bar on one hand, and this one and that one on the other hand. So what this means is that in the end, even accounting for the cost of the intervention, the cost of the two groups, and taking into account the baseline differences, the cost of the two groups are almost the same. So a $10 investment out of a kind of $22,000 and a bit more per person per year average cost of the intervention, a $10 investment for the high-need group saves about $9.60. This is our kind of latest estimate version, whatever, 16 or whatever it is. We're not completely done. It's not totally final, but with every successive iteration, we're getting more and more confident that it's about that. And the major cost offsets are kind of, surprisingly, kind of office visits for not hospital, but other providers outside of this study. There's quite a bit of substitution that seems to be going on. People were getting services from various community providers, and they're not doing that anymore because they're getting the intervention. So that saves about $4,500 on average. Less physical hospitalization. This is, again, for the high-need group. Less emergency shelter use, not surprisingly. Less kind of home visits, again, non-study services, again, some substitution. And somewhat less jail or prison. So I've just recorded here what exceeds $1,000 in either increases or decreases in cost. For the moderate need group, and Stephen's comments on service use kind of hinted at this finding, the impact in terms of cost offsets is less than for the high need group because kind of the moderate need group is not using as many services to begin with, so there's less opportunity to realize savings. And so here, kind of, there is a kind of larger difference in cost at the end of the day. So that $10 invested in the intervention, which costs about $14,000, saves about $3.42. So there's some cost offset, but part of what does it is that there's actually more non-study office visits going on. So it seems that kind of the intervention is uncovering needs once people are housed. Needs emerge that that lead participants to get some more services of certain kinds. But there is a sizable reduction in emergency shelter use as well as in SROs with supports. So strengths and limitations. So this was a randomized trial, large sample, good follow-up rates, unit costs estimated in a consistent manner. We really tried to do that. I had no idea how much work this would end up being. And then limitations, kind of that this relies on self-report data. Ideally, we would have administrative data all over the place. We know kind of, there's a number of studies that suggest that self-report data going back 3 months is not too bad overall, but we can see from our comparisons with the administrative data that we do have that kind of we're not tracking perfectly by any means, but at least kind of we're doing this for both an experimental and a control group in the same way. So in principle, kind of there shouldn't be that much difference between the group sets driven by the fact that we're using self-reports. The differences are not yet tested statistically, medication costs not yet included, some difficulty in isolating the non-study visits at most sites, actually. That's something I haven't mentioned yet, but at most of the sites, people did not isolate what were visits from Housing First providers versus other providers, and we had to do some approximations based on data we collected at the very end of the study. So there's some error around that for sure. And we are moving toward doing like formal cost effectiveness analyses with bootstrapping and all that. But we're not ready to present those results yet. So conclusions from the economic analysis. I don't think I'll just repeat everything I've just said. So I'll thank you for your attention. And I guess I'll just say a few words. Maybe you're wondering, well, what's happened as a result of this study? How much influence has it had on policy? The picture varies across provinces. At one extreme, we have the Toronto site, where kind of this Housing First intervention was not completely unlike Streets to Homes, which the government had already decided to fund for some years, and they've decided to just continue to fund the services. So that's at one extreme. And the other extreme is my site, where there's, some of you may have heard of the fact that the province of Quebec has threatened to separate from the rest of Canada a few times, and we've had referenda on that. Well, there's huge sensitivity to federal intrusion into an area of provincial jurisdiction. So the just because this comes from the federal government, the provincial government, decided there was no way it was going to fund this thing. So they're just funding transitioning of participants to usual services. And plus, we have a lot of community traditional providers who don't like this approach because we're relying on private apartments. We're helping to fund private landlords instead of contributing to the stock of publicly owned social housing. So, two strikes against us, and we were out. But haven't completely given up hope yet that eventually we'll realize that kind of this is a better way to help homeless people. So, and the other provinces are somewhat in between. There was a policy forum, we're 1 week ago, at which representatives of the four provinces other than Quebec were present. And it was pretty apparent that this has made them think quite a bit about how to deal with services for homeless people. And also, the federal government has decided to reorient a large part of the money that had been providing for homeless services toward funding housing first types of services. So there is kind of a policy impact there. Unfortunately, they're not giving additional money to continue to fund usual services and then add more to develop housing first. They're just cutting funds for traditional services to replace it with housing first, which is much more difficult to manage. So I guess I'll stop here and invite questions for either Stephen or myself. Thank you for your attention.
Yeah, and actually, if you could just leave it on that last slide. And
yes.
When you guys respond, if you respond into the microphone,
yeah.
This recorder, all the people who couldn't make it, including Sam, I guess, can come and watch your presentation. I actually would love, and I'm going to start, sorry, to hear a little bit more about follow-up. We didn't hear much of that in the presentation, and that's really, that's mind-blowing to many of us who research in this community, or with this community. Can you talk a little bit about what lengths you had to go to? What were the success stories?
Do you want to speak to it? Do you have to repeat the question into the mic?
Yes. So the question is about how did we achieve the fairly high follow-up rates that we did? Actually, there was some variation across sites in kind of follow-up rates. I think Toronto, for example, had a harder time achieving high follow-up rates with the treatment as usual group because there are many more shelters. It's rather more difficult to track them. But I would say we tried to, A, look at what the literature suggested were effective methods, and we tried to implement a lot of what was in the literature with a few additional innovations. The Montreal site actually had very high follow-up rates, over 90% in both groups, no differential attrition. And we did a whole range of things to track participants. One of the very helpful things was the welfare office was willing to give us information, because we had it in a consent form, was willing to give us information about where they were mailing welfare checks. So that helped a lot. We used social media. We found one participant through Facebook who had moved to Haiti. We're able to call him in Haiti and do a good part of an interview with him on the phone to Haiti. There was another participant who we discovered doing a Google search had been imprisoned in Halifax. We were able to contact the prison and interview him in prison in Halifax. So we had kind of a very resourceful team of interviewers. I would say a couple of other things. Here's an interesting story. I found a very intelligent homeless person whom I met at my church, actually, and invited him to come and help me write the consent form. And the consent form was a standard consent form offering equal compensation for participating in interviews for the experimental and TAU groups. He said, that is never going to work. He said, homeless people are very, very sensitive to injustice. They're going to look at your study and say, this is very unfair. These guys here are getting all these services and the other ones are getting nothing. You can't do that. The people in the experimental group are going to quit your study once they find this out and they're going to talk to each other just out of solidarity with the others. So he said, you have to give a higher compensation for the people in the TAU group. And he said, they'll know that it's still unfair, but at least you realize it was unfair, so you did something about it. So then I told him, well, that's fine, but how am I going to justify that to an ethics committee? Yeah. It's supposed to be compensation for kind of time lost. He said, well, circumstances are very different when you're housed versus when you're in the street. If you're housed, you have a fridge, so you can store food. You're not as dependent on what you're able to collect in panhandling and so on that very day. And you can't go to soup kitchens every day. So you get sick if you do that. So he said, so basically I was able to translate that into an opportunity cost of time argument being greater if you're on the street and it passed ethics. So there was a lot of different measures, but I would say a lot of it was interviewers who were on the field a lot and who had a team-based approach. So it wasn't one interviewer was responsible for these people, it was really the team. And they knew a lot of the people on the street, and if they saw one, kind of, they could do an interview right there on the fly. So, but it was pretty feasible.
Congratulations.
So I can answer the question is about the rent subsidies, how did they work, and were they included in the cost analysis? So the way it worked is that the rent subsidies flowed from, they were part of the funding for the project. At each site, they were flowed to a project, housing coordinator who essentially flowed that money to the landlords. And there was an arrangement made with each province's, social services department that rent supplement would not be considered part of the person's income and therefore deducted from their welfare or disability entitlements. It varied depending on the site. So actually, the rent supplement was actually quite generous. In Toronto, it was $600 a month. In other cities, I think it went down to as low as $400 a month. And that was, I think it was included in the economic analysis.
Yes, it was included in the economic analysis, absolutely. But it did, I mean, what Stephen just gave you were the averages, which did have to vary by city because rent levels are not the same in Toronto as in Montreal, for example. But they did vary by individual, so that individuals had to pay 25 or 30%, kind of depending on whether heat was included or not in the rent, of their income towards the rent. So, yes?
I'm from the city of Ottawa, and as chair of the health board as well as past chair of the housing board. And I want to talk about one little program we have, and I can get your comments on it. We put $14 million into homelessness, which is something, but of course totally inadequate. But we tried to do everything out of that, rent stuff, food subsidies, and we have a controlled alcohol program in some of our shelters, where a doctor from the local hospital provides alcohol over so many hours. And this has taken the homeless off the street, no longer involved with police and the justice system, and driving the business crazy, and the whole range of things. And they're very happy. They get 25 cents a shower. They save their money. When the doctor went to the shelter one day, it was empty, and they were all in a local restaurant having lunch together. So the restaurant didn't phone. It was very quiet, peaceful. They've all become very collegiate. So as a result, we have bought a former motel, and they've all moved out there together because they had become friends and were using the support of each other. And so although we do the single unit in the building as well, it has turned out to really work to create a cohesive group and then use that as a way to transport them out to a permanent housing situation where they remain because they're very happy. But you obviously didn't agree with that. You only went to the single unit, I gather.
So the question is about managed alcohol program in a congregate setting.
Yeah, well, the question is...
I can answer the question. So in brief, the model that was favored was scattered site independent units in apartment buildings. There were some sites in which there were congregate dwellings, so like single room occupancy type hotels or places where there were a number of participants living together in a special building or a special site. But the model was essentially based on the I think the pretty clear demonstration that we know that people, when given the choice, do you want to live in a place with lots of other people who were recently homeless, and or do you want to live in your own apartment in a regular building? Most people prefer scattered site. But this study did not specifically test the motto that you're describing, which is managed alcohol in a congregate setting. Yes. So the question is how to interpret the percent of time spent stably housed in the Housing First group. So just to give you an example, 70% is kind of the number to remember. About 70% of time was spent stably housed. Most of that reflects the fact that it took time to move people from the moment of randomization to getting them stably housed took time. For some people, it could happen within a matter of weeks, but for others, it took months. And so that 30% of the time essentially not housed reflects partly the 30% of the year that it took to move them into housing. It also reflects the fact that for a small proportion of people, as Eric mentioned, maybe 10%, it was quite difficult to move them into stable housing. And for a very small proportion, they never moved into stable housing. So that 30% not stably housed reflects mostly the time it took to transition people to housing, but also a small number of people who never got housed, and then also some people who lost their housing and then regained it.
Okay, if I can just add one thing, the way we defined stably housed was we had a number of types of housing that we considered to be stable housing. If they were like permanent, in principle permanent housing, we called it stable housing. So somebody could move from one apartment to another apartment because they didn't like the first, or because they were evicted and we found another apartment for them, that still would be stable housing in both cases, even though it turned out to be unstable.
Yes? I have a follow-up to the rent collection, the rent question. So what were the consequences if they didn't pay their portion of the rent? You mentioned eviction. Was the cost of eviction factored into the
I can address that. So the rent supplement from the program was paid directly to the landlord by the program, and in almost every case, the person's 30% proportion of the rent that they had to pay out of their income was also paid directly from their typically the welfare or disability payment to the landlord. So that there were relatively few people who were evicted for non-payment of rent, actually. The majority, I think, were evicted due to problems in the unit, often with, as Eric referred to, just having people come in, and people would come in and take over the unit, and then they would have to move out.
There was probably some variation across sites in terms of that, though.
Yeah?
Basically, we took the expenses of all the programs, so the clinical teams, the housing team, the rent supplements, the insurance, etc. So yes.
You want to take two more questions? The gentleman there?
Yeah. First of all, this is a remarkable study. Congratulations. I'm curious about the non-housing factors that we thought increases in quality of life and for both groups. And were the providers of treatment of mutual or the interventions the same providers across locations? And in terms of the case managers, were they the same case managers? And also, to what degree do you think that there was a Hawthorne effect going on?
Oh, okay.
Maybe I can address the first question. Actually, so the question is, were the case managers providing service to the intervention as well as usual care participants? The answer to that is no. In every case, the treatment intervention group was receiving service from a dedicated service team that was not part of the usual care mix in the community. The question about the Hawthorne effect is an excellent one. You know, I think you're asking, did being in the usual care group improve outcomes simply by being observed? I think that there has been some discussion among our research team as to whether the research encounters were in and of themselves therapeutic and may have provided some benefit for our participants. The answer is it's possible, but we are not able to answer the question, did that really happen or not?
Yeah. I'll just add very briefly that, can we talk about this about I talk about this with the Montreal interviewers at any rate, and their impression was that it really didn't make that much difference. The participants appreciated being met every 3 months or 6 months, but it's not that much in this whole amount of their lives. Yes, there was one final question, yes? I'm not able to answer that question.
Yeah. Can you? The question is, was there differential effects by age groups? We haven't done those analyses. We have relatively few very young people in the group, so it would be younger adults versus older adults. There would not be any youth in the sample, but the answer is we haven't done those analyses yet. It's a good question.
They're on their way, though, I think.
Yeah, someone will do them. It's 4 past the hour, so I think we're supposed to stop.
Well, I think we're all very much looking forward to the next round when we can have the two-year outcomes data reported. But in the meantime, thank you very much for coming.